This week on Writers, Inc.
Also, go outside of your own world. Bring in other people. I think that is one of the most beautiful things you can do as an author, is to celebrate the work of others. And right. In that in-between phase, that's a great way of celebrating them, building relationships so they want to celebrate you, you know, on your next launch, showing that your expertise that you share is not just limited to what you know, but what you admire and what others have to say.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So Christine was going to ask me about tombstones.
Yeah, what is going on with this tombstone TikTok countdown on your social media?
I didn't think anybody would even see that. So I'm guessing a lot of people that are listening to the show are probably following what's happening with TikTok. So they appealed to the Supreme Court, like a look on the state level. It got kicked back. So the only thing that can basically save TikTok at this point is if the Supreme Court decides to take up the case. So I've been watching this really closely. I just started posting tombstones on, I've been putting them on Threads because like that's the only social media platform that I don't really have a presence on. Like I've got a profile there, but I don't do anything. So I didn't think anybody even saw those, but yeah, I've been counting down since like 45 or something. Yeah. Apparently Christine knows all my social media accounts.
Yeah.
Like on TikTok though, like if you scroll it, like the chatter is just weird because a lot of people, you know, are acting as if this isn't going to happen. And then other people are saying that you need to move to another platform called Lemonade, they've made it very easy to migrate everything. Like you basically just turn it on and like it will migrate all of your TikTok data over. But the problem is it's owned by the same company that owns TikTok. So as far as I know, from a legal standpoint, it's going to get shut down when TikTok does. So I don't know if that's a viable option. And then I've seen other people say, well, Trump loves TikTok. He's going to save it. But, you know, there's a reason that it, you know, the ban goes into effect on January 19th instead of January 20th. And as president, he can't overturn, you know, something that was passed as law in a bill. You know, he can't do that with an executive order. So at best case, he can, you know, tell the Justice Department not to, you know, pursue it. But I don't know if he would even go that route because that would set a whole other precedent. So, I mean, from what I can tell it, like this thing is going away.
I'm just surprised that people think Trump likes TikTok. I mean, maybe he does. I'm not on the platform. I just thought Twitter was his thing.
Nah, he doesn't do anything on Twitter anymore. Hasn't since he got booted. He gets his stuff. He does all his stuff on his own platform, Truth Social. That's where he spends his time.
Yeah, I think the reason that they're bringing up Trump with TikTok is because in a lot of ways it helped him win the election. He got a ton of support on TikTok younger demographics that he wouldn't have received before. But he's come out public like years back. He hated TikTok and then he came out in support of it. And now it seems like he's kind of on the fence because he sees all these different platforms as kind of being the same thing. You know, if TikTok goes away, another one is going to step up. And, you know, so I mean, I've talked to a lot of people that are following this closely. And, you know, like when they presented this information to the Senate, to Congress, to all the lawmakers, whatever it is that they've got that basically tied this, you know, platform back to China, that scared the crap out of them. And it's not public information, so nobody knows what's in there. But if you look at those actual votes, you know, like only a handful of people voted against this after seeing that presentation. It went way beyond bipartisan. Like this was a landslide vote against TikTok. So there is something horrible in that information. And I'm sure sooner or later it will come out.
This is a good cautionary tale, though, for authors and really anybody. Like, don't depend on a single platform for building your personal platform. Like, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Don't put your real estate in the metaverse.
Meanwhile, your toaster can still spy on you. So,
mine can't. It doesn't have spyware in it. Can all toaster? Mine's old. I don't think it can spy on me.
No, any of the any smart appliance can.
I don't have any smart appliances. I keep getting like messages from like my energy company, upgrade to smart thermostats, and I'm like, no, yeah. I will not.
No, I
No,
have
don't
heard
do that.
more horror stories, especially here in Vegas, where people do the smart electric thing. And then in the summertime, you know, when it's 10 million degrees because we live on the surface of the sun, the power company will override your settings. And so that you can't have your air conditioning at whatever setting you want.
So that happened here in Austin, like not this past summer, but like maybe 2 years ago. And man, people were practically rioting in the streets. There's no way they were gonna allow that. So they were ripping those
That's
things out of the wall and
crazy.
going
That
to
is
like the
interesting.
restore and getting used like analog ones.
Okay, so I am getting my garage door opener. You know, the thing in your ceiling that opens your garage door. The circuit board is fried. It's really old. I think it's from the 90s. So I'm getting it replaced, and I was going to do the one you can open from your phone. Should
Well,
I
go ahead.
change my mind and go analog? Talk me out of
That's
it.
not a problem,
That's okay.
though. Like,
Well,
what are they
unless
gonna
someone
do?
can ha well, they can hack it and open your garage door and then
No
rob you.
more than they could hack the remote control ones anyway. My friends and I used to drive
I guess
around,
that's
and we had
true.
this little thing that you get that would basically like scan, and if someone happened to be opening their garage door while we drove by, it would capture it, and then we could come back and open their garage door,
Was
and it
this
would
one of your
mess with people.
careers?
Yeah, this
I
was one
won't
of my
ask
careers.
whether it was a legitimate career.
This
I mean, you could
was
have been a garage
a,
door
and this was back in like
salesman.
the 90s. I mean, this was,
Yeah, that's
forever.
true.
This
I
is back in
remember
my
doing
engineering days.
that. Okay, but I do have an analog lock that leads to the garage, so maybe I'll
All
get the
right, so
smart
you're fine.
opener. Yeah, okay.
All right.
I, for one, welcome our AI overlords. They can have full control of everything in my home. Welcome, AI.
I'm pretty sure it's China. Like once they're done figuring, like they're scoping everything out with the drones, then when they eventually invade us and Christine tries to get out of her garage, they're gonna close her door and keep her in there so
You're
she
trapped.
can't get out.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what's gonna
I
happen.
have a chainsaw. Like every good Canadian, I have a chainsaw. I'll be
As soon as
fine.
she's walking out of the garage, they're gonna drop the door on her like a guillotine.
No. That's terrifying.
Maximum Overdrive Part 2.
Oh boy. All right, Kevin, what is in the actual real news?
The actual news, the more boring news. Final judgment, AAP's victory over Internet Archive becomes permanent, and now they'll get paid. The Association of American Publishers, AAP, secured a decisive and permanent legal victory against the Internet Archive for its unauthorized mass digital lending. After losing in district court in 2023 and the Court of Appeals in September 2024, the Internet Archive chose not to appeal the Supreme Court by the December deadline, making the ruling final. The Internet Archive must now make a confidential payment to the AAP as part of a previously negotiated agreement. The Second Circuit Court rejected the argument that, quote, controlled digital lending is anything but infringement, affirming the importance of copyright law in protecting authors and publishers, regardless of whether actions are for profit or non-commercial.
Yeah, we've been following this one for a while. I just got to say, about time. Hopefully, this puts it to bed.
We're all going to get a check for like 12 cents.
Yeah, I know. That's the real fun part is like, this doesn't, I guess there is a benefit in that the copyright is being protected and it's being shown to be protected, which does matter. Like, in copyright law, showing that you're willing to fight and protect a copyright or IP is as important as the victory, because otherwise there's like loopholes and things that will cause the IP to fall into public domain if no one's willing to stand up and fight for it, which is why Starbucks always goes after everybody, sends a letter of cease and desist if you use the word Frappuccino. It doesn't matter. They don't care. They're not going to chase you down, take you to court probably, but they do defend the IP because otherwise they'll lose it.
That's fascinating. I saw that actually makes a lot of sense now. I wish I had known you like 5 years ago because I know that there was a scuffle in the Bookstagram community when Bookstagram started to get really popular. And so you had all these Etsy shops then start to open up with different fandoms. And, you know, some authors were very welcoming to people. You know, you want to make a bookmark or a t-shirt, that's fine. And then others legit sold cease and desists. to everyone. And there were a lot of people who were like, I'm just doing this because I love books. Like, I can't believe that you're being so mean to me. And no one, I don't think, ever really got an explanation on why some authors sent like actual legal cease and desist letters to like some, tiny little Etsy shop with, 12
Stuff
sales.
gets contentious though. Like right now there's a lawsuit happening, and it's all about Sad Beige, and it's there's a TikToker who has made her living doing like the whole Sad Beige look, and so she does things like her clothing and her space, and she does like all these arrangements and stuff. And there's another TikToker who apparently knew her, who's just aped everything she's done. And so she's suing the TikToker B over copyright infringement. So she's trying to claim copyright on the look. And I'm watching this closely because I feel like that's one of the more dangerous IP cases out there. Because if she wins, it's going to open a door for a whole lot of people to get screwed, because all anyone would have to do is say, it's too similar to mine. And so I own all that person's IP. And that'll extend into all kinds of things.
Well, what about that Orange Prince case? Remember that IP case? Wasn't that a Warhol? He just took a picture of Prince that was owned by someone else and made it orange. And I believe he lost that case because it was too similar.
It wasn't
But
enough
I
of
mean,
a,
wearing beige, okay, I wouldn't do it, first of all, because anything I wear in a yellow tone makes me look jaundiced and like I need to go to the hospital. But that aside, like just wearing beige, like how can you? I
It's
don't
not
know.
just
I don't
beige.
get
I mean,
it.
it's the style. She's claiming that she her intellectual property is the style. So the thumbnails she uses, the clothes she wears in the thumbnails, the way she, decorates a room is her
Man, that's going to be a
signature
hard
style.
case.
Right.
Yeah,
I
I
hope
can
she
see.
loses big.
I'm trying to look at this from both sides, and I could see her actually winning this thing.
I know.
Yeah,
That's what worries
it's
me.
possible. And you're right. Yeah, like that's a scary precedence to set. But if she can establish that that's her thing, that she's known for that, and she was the first to that, like it's possible they could actually rule in her favor.
Well, yeah, this is the problem in music. If you use a chord progression that's too similar to this other song, then you can be sued, lose the rights to your song. It's crazy. That's why,
Unless you're
Taylor
George
Swift, among
Harrison.
others,
Remember that
they've gone. Yeah, I remember that.
one?
Yeah. And that's happened a lot in the music industry. So, and look at what great shape that industry's in. So, yeah. We should fight this. We should lend our voices. And it's happening in a Texas court. So I'm hoping my
So I
Texas
just want to
brethren.
know when I start making my Silas 6'4 t-shirts if JD's going to send me a cease and desist. No, I'm just
Oh,
kidding.
absolutely. Right
Absolutely.
after I go outside and hang my beige flag in support of this whole thing.
Okay, perfect.
Sad beige, JD. All right. OpenAI. Let's get the next story. OpenAI has finally released Sora. OpenAI has finally launched Sora publicly. The tool turns text into video with highly impressive results. Sora can also animate images and remix videos. It's available now for ChatGPT Plus and Pro subscribers in the US, with a wider rollout coming soon. The launch follows criticism from artists who say that they were used for unpaid testing during development.
Oh, has anyone made a book trailer yet? Have you tried it?
I haven't. I played around with it very briefly yesterday. I've been playing with a music AI called Sona that is very impressive, and I want to marry these two and create. I've got some things in mind, but yeah, I only touched it a bit, and it had an error or something when I tried to log in, so I kind of gave up pretty quickly. Has anyone else played with it?
I don't even know if I have access to it and yet, but I should probably check that. Being Canada or America's 51st state, maybe I have access. I don't know.
I've seen a bunch of videos posted from it, and it's crazy impressive how good it works. I had sent another one to Kevin, kind of off topic, but we were talking about, we had AI Kevin read the news the other day. I found another one where you can create a video avatar of yourself. You basically, from what I understand, you just have to read some scripts on video, and then once it captures enough information, it's able to recreate that. I haven't tried it yet, and I want to dig into the legal side of that and actually read the terms of service, just to see if, like, once you create that AI avatar of yourself, like, is it exclusive to just you, or does it go into some database where they can then license it out and let other people use it? Because this particular platform actually started with AI avatars, you know, that you could use, and you know, they all had to come from somewhere.
Well, I'm gonna watch what you do with Sora, JD, because I always know you do some different stuff pretty quickly. So I'm have expectations. What are you gonna do with Sora? Let's see it.
I've been finding, you know, like I do a ton of Facebook ads, and like Facebook will throw a lot of like they really put a lot of weight behind video ads. Like they prefer to show video ads, but my click-through ratio is better on the, you know, the static ads, just on the image ads. So I don't know that it's worthwhile. But it kind of goes back to like book trailers. You know, like book trailers are a fantastic idea in theory, but you know, when people see them, like they're used to a big Hollywood blockbuster film trailer. So unless you can create something that competes with that, you know, it's going to be subpar. So it's not, it's going to hurt you instead of help you, because it looks, you know, amateurish.
Yeah, but
The
look,
video coming
you're
out of
getting there. I think you could probably do that now
That's
with
the thing.
this.
Yeah, the videos coming out of this platform are very good. I mean, they're strong. So yeah, I think if it's not happening yet, I think it could actually get us there.
Well, last story of the day. Google Docs adds 40 new templates to spruce up your documents. Google Docs is introducing 40 new pageless templates with modern designs for tasks like blog posts, project roadmaps, and interview guides. These templates, gradually rolling out between December 10th and 25th, include features like tabs and placeholders, chips, and will be accessible to all Google account users and Workspace subscribers. Sounds like they're kind of making a play for Canvas turf. That's what I think. Something like that.
Do you guys use Google Docs? Like Christine and I are using it for the Flatliners thing because it's an easy place to go back and forth on. And
I have
my
to use it
publicist
for
uses it.
work.
Do you?
I
Okay.
don't. I don't prefer it. I prefer Word for a number of reasons. I mean, I know that they all read you, but you know, Google, because it is the Google Docs. Like I've heard from writers that they read everything that you store there and use it for.
You're such a conspiracy theorist. I thought I was bad, but
Hey,
man.
I am just saying what I have heard people say. All right. I don't know. I don't work for Google. It would not shock me. The only thing I think when I hear things, I have one question. What's the incentive? And if the incentive makes sense, then I go, yeah, it's probably true. And I think, yeah, it's probably true.
I remember that we were talking about I was going to put a document just for full of like erotic phrases and see if it got flagged in Google, but I never did it. So I don't know, maybe I should just try
Yeah,
and
I
see
mean,
if
who
anything
knows? See if it
I
got
don't know.
flagged in Google Docs. You
Yeah,
think they
yeah,
would?
that they had their account shut down. So it was from the erotica community, and they had said that be careful if you share your manuscript in Google Docs because they will flag it as like pornography. Now listen, some of these people write about a lot of things that maybe they should
Yeah, I was about to ask how
think.
taboo was this, because
I don't know. All right, I'm not. I wasn't there. I wasn't them. I haven't read anything that they've read, so I have no idea. I just know that there was quite a kerfluffle on the app formerly known as Twitter, and I just tucked that piece of information away and thought, all right, well, let's see what happens. But you know, everyone is using your data to train their own version of AI and algorithms, and you know that's true because you can talk about something and an ad will come up for it. Like that's a thing that happens. That's not a conspiracy. So.
Yeah, I've found it pretty interesting that no matter what book I ask about, ChatGPT always knows how to answer me. So, hey, you know, in my book, Girl in the Mayan Tomb, I talk about owls. Could you tell me what I wrote about owls? And it gave me a whole thing about what I wrote about
So,
owls.
you know, it's getting that somewhere. I don't know. Anyway, it's fine. I don't
Well,
know.
Jen, you brought up a good point. I mean, if you flip this on its head and look at this from Google's standpoint, what is the point of Google creating Google Docs in the first place? You know, they're not charging for this service, but they're
Right.
obviously putting a lot of money behind it. It costs a fortune to store all this data. So there's got to be something going on there, and you know, it comes
Well,
back to,
they're
you know.
using it. I don't know what they're using it for, but they're using it.
Somebody needs to read those terms of service.
But they're open about that kind of thing. I remember when I don't know if you guys remember Goog 411, when they had their own, like you could call for information at Google and you dialed Goog 411. They ran that for like 5 or 6 years, and then they shut it down. And I really loved it because it was a free information call at a time where the internet wasn't as readily available or reliable for that kind of thing. But they were using that to train AI, basically, even back then in like the late 90s. They were training it to recognize voices and phrases, and you were voice training their stuff for them back then. So that's absolutely what they do. They're pretty open about it. We are
Sneaky,
all owned.
sneaky.
All right, that's all the news for this week.
All right, JD, who is up this week?
All right, this week we've got Marissa Eigenbrode coming on. With more than 2 decades behind her at the head of Smith Publicity, Marissa is going to dig in deep on book marketing and publicity campaigns. She's going to cover everything that's working and everything that's not working in today's environment. Here she is, Marissa.
First off, a quick note from your past. You worked at Campbell's Soup at one point. And so publicity for those guys must have been cake. I mean, soup's been around for like 30,000 years. Campaign could be like, soup, it's hot, it's wet. Sometimes there's chunks. Try it with the all new bread.
Oh my gosh. Sure.
How did you get involved with Campbell's? That must have been an amazing experience.
It really was. You know, Campbell's primary headquarters is in Camden, New Jersey, which is not too far from where I am right now in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. So my dad actually worked at Campbell's Soup for 27 years. And so that was kind of where, you know, a little, I guess, a little nepotism in the world of Campbell's Soup. I had a little bit of an inroad to first, a department that had never had an intern before. So first, I started off with an internship, and they never had someone come in with that. And it was a department called Campbell's Kitchen, which makes it actually was all about doing the recipe testing for the recipes you see on the back of the can. So if you're gonna do cream of mushroom soup, what does the cream of the chicken noodle casserole look like when you're using that, and how do we create the content and the description for the back of the can and make sure all the details are right on it, and test a few different ways of how much paprika do we put in or this or that. So that was a really fun inroad. I got to taste a lot of things and be a part of that. And my eye came into the kind of editing and writing of it all. And then the next summer after that, I got to work in the public affairs department, where it was a really interesting combination of more internal communications was what I got to be a part of, which was really special. Seeing how important that was at a big corporate level of what we say, you know, externally, what we say to our customers, our stakeholders, our investors, you know, is equally, if not more important than what we say to our internal employees around engagement and how we roll certain initiatives out and such. So that was really interesting to see kind of both sides of the coin in that corporate environment overall. And one little thing that the history there doesn't tell you, the overview my time at Campbell's before doesn't tell you, is that why I was an intern there, while my dad worked there was an amazing CEO named Doug Conant, who was overseeing Campbell's Soup at the time. Fast forward many years that I was at Smith, all of a sudden the opportunity came to be that, and what people can't see is I'm pulling a book out of a stack right here. This is Doug Conant's book, and we got to promote it all these years later. And so it's a really full
Oh.
circle moment to get to watch Doug be a CEO and an amazing CEO at that at Campbell Soup, and then to actually get a chance to promote his book many years later here at Smith. So
That's very
amazing
neat.
full circle Campbell Soup moment there.
It must be very, very cool. So how did you go from Marissa? You ended up being, you know, it was a bit of a family business, the Campbell Soup, but then suddenly you're moving into book publicity, which is a pretty, I don't want to say niche, but it's especially when Dan Smith first started, it was pretty unique, especially with independent authors.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I knew that I wanted to get into the world of PR. It was what I studied in college. It was what I had you know, really saw that I loved writing, but I liked it in a succinct way. I liked communicating with people. And so I graduated in 2008, which was a wonderful time to graduate, aka recession year. I, through a mutual friend, found out about this small book publicity agency in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I said, well, I like reading. I like books a lot. I didn't know book PR was an option when I was in college. I kind of thought about the entertainment side of it in terms of movies and TV and fashion and such. And I interviewed. I got the job as a publicist here. And 15 years later this month, here I am still.
That's great.
This was where I was meant to be, truly. I'm so thankful for that connection 15 years ago. to not only end up at Smith, which is my truly my second family, but to end up in this world where I have met so many brave people, because that's what authors are. Authors are brave individuals. They are willing to put their ideas, their thoughts, their inspirations, their vulnerabilities on the line and on the page, and we get to represent that. So I'm so thankful that, you know, serendipitously I ended up here.
Well, we love you being here. Anything to support what authors do, obviously. Some nuts and bolts. Mm-hmm. You know, we always hear in the world of publicity, there's no such thing as bad publicity. And I wonder if that's true, especially because there's a bit of a social media trend at the moment, has been for a while, of like putting out posts you know will get attacked, because then that raises the, you know, the engagement, and then you can grow followers that way. So so these days, does that maxim still hold water, or does it mean more because of how social media works? Is bad publicity as good as good publicity?
Is it great to have your viral moment if you get to have one? Sure. Is that going to bring a lot of people into your, I like to call it your brand ecosystem that you kind of create around yourself as an author? Absolutely. But are they going to stay with you is the question. And so when you do, you know, post something that you hope evokes a certain response from people, you know, and is it really truly going to keep people engaged? Is it just for reaction's sake, or are those people actually going to take action? So it's one thing to have some followers, but are those people going to buy your book? Are they going to, if you're like in the nonfiction space and you offer other offerings like courses or speaking or whatever else it could be, or just in general, you have something else beyond a book for someone to engage with, are those people actually taking steps toward that engagement, or are they just following along to see what you're going to say next? And so I think that there's, I like to say there's riches and niches, and a lot of other people say that too, but I would rather see someone really emphasize and put their energy into efforts that are going to really truly build engagement and connect with your audience. So in the whole element of you know, all publicity is good publicity, I think as long as it's reaching your target audience in some way, it is. And I'd rather see it be something that's really authentic and true to who you want to be as an author than trying to do something just so you get people riled up.
And I guess it goes to something I know you've spoken before about the idea of launching a brand rather than just a book. So you might get attention for the book at this moment, but you know, social media and things that are online, this is forever now. And so if you get kind of known for this moment in time, that might get you that attention in the beginning, but it might hurt you in the long run. So what is it? Consideration is that when you're launching a book, that you're also launching this legacy. I mean, how much does that play into this?
Yeah. For most authors, their book is not the only thing they're ever going to launch. It's not one book and done. Sometimes it's multiple books. I actually just had a really lovely conversation with an author last week who is coming up on her 9th book next year. And she has done a fantastic job of, you know, just building engagement around each of her launches. But it's almost as though she launches a book, she does things around the launch, and then she moves on to planning around the next launch. And there's time in between there where you get to connect directly with that individual, where it's not so much that you're celebrating a new launch anymore. You're not talking about a pre-launch yet, but you're in this limbo stage a little bit of that. And so I think that's an important thing to think about before you launch your first book, or even if you're coming up on your 9th book, is taking that step back and really thinking about, I like to say, what's at the trunk of the tree? You know, it's this brand. It's this, everything else is a branch off of it. And each of your books and each of your offerings, but the trunk is the thing that sustains. And it doesn't, you know, any book has an expiration date on a little bit in terms of the attention it can keep garnering. And so really you're thinking about who you are in this whole process, what your role is, what this brand that you want to develop is going to be, and how you can ensure that as you're coming up on each launch, that you have this community of engaged individuals who are going to be excited to support each of your launches. And so there doesn't need to be that in-between phase of, you know, launching a book, getting people excited, and then keeping them engaged in a bit of a simmer, and then kind of having the pot boil over again as you get ready for that next launch. And that in-between phase, I think, is really where you get to show truly who you are, truly who you want to be, what you want your voice to be, what value you provide. And I think that that has to do with like your author legacy that you're developing is right. In the end, do people know you for one book or do they know you for the overall themes, messages, stories, feelings that it evoked, you know, for them? What was that ultimate kind of takeaway for your audience in the end?
So what does it look like in between book launches for, as you mentioned them? Because I think a lot of authors struggle, like I can talk about my book now, here's this thing, I'm very excited about it, here are these characters, but in between books, is it sharing the process? Is it posting funny memes? What might it be? And I know it's different for everybody, but what might that look like?
Yeah, I always love, you mentioned first, sharing the book process a little bit. And I think that it's really great to be vulnerable as is comfortable for you and feels authentic for you. But even saying, I'm exhausted from the last book, you know, and yeah, right. We're still building energy, but I'm exhausted. I'm ready to take a little bit of a break. It doesn't have to always be, you know, sharing what we're jumping right into the next book, what that mentality is. But I do love kind of giving a glimpse into the aftermath and the, you know, pre-launch of it all process of writing, of getting inspiration, of coming up with characters and ideas and storylines and format and everything. I think it's also, again, it really dives into how much you want to get into yourself, your personal life. I'm certainly not saying to post all of your, you know, coffee pictures at breakfast. It's not that at all, but it is a little bit of, you know, maybe for your next book, or maybe you go on a family vacation where you were really inspired by something and you talk about that, right. And a certain, you know, location you went to, or a restaurant that evoked a certain feeling. I'm saying the word evoke a lot today. But it really, you know, sparks a certain feeling that you have in yourself. Also go outside of your own world, bring in other people. I think that is one of the most beautiful things you can do as an author, is to celebrate the work of others. And right. In that in-between phase, that's a great way of celebrating them, building relationships. So they want to celebrate you, you know, on your next launch. And I share often with our nonfiction authors, if you're an expert in a space, showing that your expertise that you share is not just limited to what you know, but what you admire and what others have to say, or, you know, sharing an article that someone else wrote and giving a few thoughts of, you know, your connection to that. So it could be that if you're a fiction author in the thriller space, and there's another thriller author who you think is, you know, kind of runs in parallel with you a bit. Yeah. It's friendly competitors, you know, share their, you know, content too, and share your thoughts as well.
You know, it's funny. When authors go to cocktail parties, and just using that as kind of a catch-all, a very common thing to hear is like, oh, I've got an idea for a book. I'll give the idea, you write it, and then we'll split the profits. You hear that a lot. You hear a lot from people. I just wonder, as a publicist, when you go into those sort of spaces, what's one of the most common things people say to you?
What's the difference between marketing and publicity? Right. That's one of the questions I get most often, for sure. And going back to your point, though, I've actually seen a major uptick in fiction ghostwriting, which I find very interesting. I didn't really know that could be a thing, but I thought that was so interesting to see actually how many people are leaning on ghostwriters for fiction ideas. But going back to that question, yeah, I definitely find the difference between publicity and marketing to be one that comes up very often. And My answer to that is, I try to keep it really clear in that with marketing, it's direct to consumer. You get to control the message that's delivered through a website, social media channels, a newsletter, a podcast. Whatever you're saying gets delivered in that way on the other side as you wanted to frame it and say it, and you're reaching your consumer directly.
Exactly.
Whereas with publicity, exactly, yes. Publicity, we have a middleman between us, which is the media. We have a TV station, we have a podcast, we have a radio host, or we have an article writer, you know, in some way, and a book reviewer, where we don't get to control the whole narrative on what comes out on the other side. We don't get to control the questions that are going to be asked necessarily. But what that does do is it adds in a new layer of credibility, of backing to who you are, your work, what you're saying, because you have this entity that doesn't owe you anything, that, right. You know, we're going after earned media and how we talk about publicity, that is is vouching for you, is vouching for your work, is supporting you in some way. So that's adding this other layer of credibility and excitement to your platform overall. So I would say they're so intertwined together.
So let's say we've got Jasmine, and she is like a historical romance author or something. What mm-hmm. should she be doing? And for nonfiction, I know I can pitch my expertise and say, hey, listen, I know about this, know about that.
Sure.
But so she's just starting out. Jasmine just starting out as, for example, like we were saying, a historical romance author. What should be some of mm-hmm. her first steps of getting publicity?
Yeah. I mean, before jumping into any publicity, I would always ask the questions of, does Jasmine have her Sunday best on? I like to say, so do we have our website set up? Do we have a social channel for engagement? You know, publicity is about building awareness. So are we ready for that awareness once it's built on the other side? So thinking about those marketing elements first, because we do a little bit, we do marketing here at Smith too. So
get that foundational set up before sort of like putting
exactly.
on the spotlight.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. You want to be ready for those eyes and ears and that opportunity for the engagement we've talked about already here. Again, going back to the conversation of those niche audiences is really, you know, if you're not hiring an agency, you want to start doing some things on your own, I would start with two different areas in particular. One is your local market. It is so powerful to reach out to any local media that you might have, even more so your local libraries, local independent bookstores. With your historical fiction book, is there a local museum that we can connect to this? Is there some kind of local entity? Think outside of the book box, I like to say. No matter what your genre is, again, where does your audience live? And so it's when you have an event at a bookstore, there's so many different genres that are housed in that bookstore that everybody's not necessarily always coming there for historical fiction or for historical romance. But if you have a place where people are seeking out historical information, if there's a book club in the area or a romance writers, group that you can be a part of, really starting with that, those grassroots efforts truly can be so impactful in building some very authentic connections and building up a following and just connecting with people who are really going to be able to lift you up. From there, I would jump over to the social media worlds, the bookstagrams, the book talkers and stuff. And we don't have to jump up to the people who have 2 million, 3 million, 5 million followers. Finding some really great individuals who have condensed followings in that area. So instead of finding a book talk influencer who covers all fiction genres potentially, or a lot of literary fiction, find someone who's really excited and passionate about talking about historical romance and diving into, you know, a group of those individuals. I will tell you, even in our work, if we have a list of 50, we might get 10 who respond. So understand that, you know, not everybody is going to write back, and that's okay. It takes work and it takes a lot of effort there. But really finding those pockets, I think, are much more impactful than being on the Today Show in that way. You know, Today Show is a brand elevator, but when we're especially in those early stages, you want to build that community up. And that's going to come from those really super engaged, condensed audiences. So those are a couple first steps.
That sounds great. So what does that approach look like? So if Jasmine's going to approach somebody on Instagram, mm-hmm. and you know, a lot of authors are introverts. So what does that look like? Am I sending like a DM? Am I sharing something with them? Do I need to send them a hard copy of the book? I mean, I know it's different every time, but in a basic sense, what does that approach look like?
With social media, you'll notice there's a lot of visual elements to that. So physical copies do come into play a good bit. You'll see often if someone's reviewing a book, they're holding up, you know, a copy of the book in a lot of cases. So that doesn't mean you have to have hundreds of copies sitting, you know, ready at your whim to mail out. But I think just having a handful, maybe, you know, 20 copies, at least for some promotional efforts, is just great to have on hand. It's also great if you're going to go to like an in-person place too, to be able to have that book to show off, maybe leave with a librarian, leave with a bookstore manager or something like that. So, you know, it's important to have your promotional pile. Might they want your pile for family and friends too, but just think about your promotional pile of physical copies there. And in terms of the outreach, one thing that's really helpful to have, no matter who you're reaching out to, is a one pager too, is a one page document. You can use Canva for free and design something really great in there. But a one page is gonna have your book cover, it has your headshot, it has your website on there, your social links, but it has a book summary, your bio, you know, just some really just great basic information, so that if you're going to hand that off to a a bookstagrammer, or you're going to they want to say, hey, send me more information. You've got this great kind of one sheet of information about yourself in the book, and also great to leave behind with that copy at any physical place. Send a DM, absolutely. Especially for those that aren't going to have those gigantic followings, they're probably actively managing their own, you know, messaging, their own social media inboxes. I think what's really valuable is sharing certain aspects of the work you think will appeal to them. So take a beat to not just say, you know, you review historical romance, I think you'll like this, but it's to say, hey, I saw that you reviewed so-and-so's book.
Right.
My book is a little similar in some ways. I think you'd really like it. Like taking a moment to show that you took some time to get to know them, get to know what they're interested in, and then sharing a little bit of that. That just goes a really long way. I mean, we do that with media all the time too. If we're pitching, you know, any kind of editor or reporter, we love to say, hey, I read your piece on this. I think this is, like, you know, really up your alley.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of value in that, because otherwise it can feel like you're one of 50 people I've sent this generic message to. So yeah, there would be sort of some value in me as the person you're approaching, that having some idea that you've actually looked into what we do. I did, and this is embarrassing to admit, but there was a time when I was sending out press releases that I pretended I had an assistant. So I had a character
name. I love it, Dick.
I know, it's so lame. I was probably overthinking it, right? But Arvind sent out all this stuff and said, hey, you should get this guy on, right, but it was me. I even set up an email address. It was really lame. I mean, we should just, I suppose, as authors, we should feel comfortable just approaching, saying, hey, this is me, and this is what I do, and I love to be involved with what you do. Yeah?
Yeah. I do think that social media in particular has allowed for more of that authentic connection than years past. It was, you know, I think previously, it was like, if your publicist isn't reaching out, you know, it felt very taboo if it was reaching out directly. So I get where you're coming from with those feelings, Dick. And you're not the first person I've heard go about it. Very creative assistant name, though. I like that. But I think that people want to build connection with people. And so there's, you know, if you're an author who's going to reach out to that particular bookstagrammer, and I say, keep it tight too. Keep your message succinct. We don't need to tell the whole story in that moment. They're reading a lot of stuff, so try to be, you know, pretty direct about your content and keep it short and sweet. But if you really build that relationship, they could say, hey, yeah, I want to have you on for, let's do a live together, let's do a giveaway too, let's do, you know, I want to support your next book, I want to make sure you keep me on your list for that. So
That's a great thought. There's a lot of value. The idea is, what could I do for you? Well, what could I do for you as an Instagrammer? What could I do for you as a social media person? What could I bring to you to help lift you up? And so rather than just, hey, do this thing for me, here's what I might be able to do for you. That's a great thought. So are there some sort of tactical things that authors can do to raise their publicity stakes?
Sure. So I think especially, you know, post-publications, where we run into a little bit of the challenge of, I can't go to reviews anymore. You know, I'm coming up on the real book-centric components of it. What's left at that stage? And, you know, we're really, really big fans of, you know, looking at your book awards to submit for at that stage. Looking into NetGalley is just still a really great resource for reviews, for keeping that energy going, and Goodreads giveaways too. Always, you know, talking about Goodreads giveaways are great post-publication, using the ebook format too. So you're not having to send out a lot of physical copies, can be a really great way to invigorate some fresh reviews and have those cross-posted to Amazon and such too.
So 15 years at Smith Publicity, what's one of the biggest changes you've seen over that time? I mean, social media, obviously, but but there were, for the longest time, press releases and book trailers and all this. Has some of those relevancies changed over those years?
It's a lot. It takes a lot to be an author today. It is a full-time job on top of the full-time job that most authors still have. It's, you know, the majority are not full-time authors. And so it's certainly not lost on us in the time and the commitment that it takes to be an author today. And so that is certainly, because 15 years ago, we got to just say, hey, I wrote a book, let's talk about it, and hold it up and, you know, show off that pretty cover. And, you know, that's not often the case anymore, where that is that kind of that easy inroad, and you just sell books because of that. So that certainly has been a big change, just the emphasis on author involvement, author platform, author content development. I will say that, you know, very apropos to the format of our conversation here, but the role of audio in the entire publishing industry as a whole, podcasts, audiobooks. I think it has just been such a huge shift and change from, you know, the time that I've been here, and just seeing the impact of both formats in creating opportunities for sales through audiobook, of connection with people. I think, again, that same thing applies in terms of connection on the podcast side too, where you're able to provide a format of that is just so, people are so voraciously consuming the audio format today. And, you know, I remember those couple of years in there where we saw the ebook numbers ticking up, and we said, oh my gosh, are ebooks going to take over print? What's that going to look like, you know, in this world? And then it started to even out, and we have to thank Gen Z and, you know, the younger generation. I think it's Alpha is next, for truly reinvigorating the physical book. It's been something that's beautifully, you know, started to go majorly on the uptick again. But then these audiobooks came into play, and seeing the numbers there and the consistency with audiobooks and the love and the call for them has, and again, the same thing with podcasts. There are so many podcasts out there, but in many cases, you're still finding this really great condensed audience, going back to that again too. So those are some just really fantastic elements and formats and such that I think are opening the door for a lot of other connection and engagement in our world. And it's been really exciting to see that.
Two real quick questions. Smith Publicity, yes. What could Smith Publicity do for an author?
At Smith, the real primary work that we do is the focus on traditional media. And again, that comes in a lot of different shapes and sizes today. But as we talked about, it's not always the easiest thing to be able to do as an author on your own. What can be easier is being yourself out there through your marketing channels. And we love to give guidance and direction through that, but love when we can empower an author with knowledge to run their marketing on their own. But on Publicity, we get to dive deep into where all of these niche pockets are, finding those right podcasts, finding those right review opportunities, finding all of those spaces to build that amazing credibility through the media that helps elevate all of the other work that they're doing on the marketing side too. And so Publicity takes time, and that is really, it is the knowledge, the connections, the relationships that we have from 27 years in business, certainly. But I think one of the greatest values of having the publicist on your side is that they can bring all of that, but they can also bring the time that it takes to find those opportunities, to open those doors for you, you know, off of your plate, and allow you to focus on those real engagement points with your audience.
Great. Last question, and I'll put it on you. What do you think, publicity-wise, one of the biggest mistakes authors make, be it a new author or someone who's been around for a while? What's, if you could go and just go to grab authors by the shoulders and say, stop doing this one thing, what might it be?
I would say is putting all of your eggs in the top-tier media, national media basket is, you know, I've heard it from all different levels of authors, is just saying, I only want the Today Show, I only want the New York Times, I only want this or that. And outside of the competition that lives in those spaces, yes, we always go for those things, but you are just missing out on beautiful opportunities for connection in other areas and truly reaching your target audience when you limit yourself in that way. So that'd be the mindset shift I'd love to see for some people to have.
Great. Thank you. Marissa, thank you so much for joining us on the show. Really, really appreciate the time.
Thank you, Dick. It was great to be here.
Okay. I thought Marissa brought up an interesting point, and it's something I've been thinking about. She said riches versus niches, or niches for us Canadians. It doesn't rhyme, though, when you say it
niches.
That way.
Niches.
Niches.
It is supposed to be niche. It's not.
It's niche. Yeah. I don't know. I say it properly, but it doesn't rhyme with riches. So it's riches and niches.
No, that's not. No.
America.
Yeah. America. No. We
absolutely
like it.
Not.
So are your readers going to stick with you? Even if you have the viral moment, are they there for your books and what you're going to put out next, or just to hear what you have to say on social media? You know, she said it's better to be authentic versus riling people up.
Oh,
and this is
something.
Yeah, I know. It was something I was thinking about. I was listening to another podcast that my friend Jeff Elkins puts out, where he was talking about, if you want to be number one, you got to start being number one in a niche. and master that before you can move up. So I just kind of wanted to hear your thoughts on this.
That jives with my sort of think local first approach to things. Because you hear about, I don't know if I was talking to you guys about this in Vegas or not, but you know, there's this concept of your 1,000 true fans, right? And everyone in this business goes and tries to land like as much attention as they can possibly get worldwide, because you know, we all want to be internationally recognized, you know, best-selling authors. Some of us, maybe not Jenna, but I kind of had this epiphany a while back that if I need 1,000 true fans, there may actually be 1,000 people in the Austin area. And so I started kind of focusing on like, what if I just built my brand locally and got it as strong as possible locally? And then I could cascade that, you know, and just kind of keep going, rippling further and further out. I think it's the same. I think that's the same kind of idea.
It's
picking a niche.
I think like when you start to break down success in any industry, like it doesn't matter what industry success you want to, I mean, first you have to like define what success is to you. I mean, and as you said, like, you know, there are some people who do want to be internationally recognized best-selling authors and, you know, have the Stephen King effect where, you know, you're in your own movies and you're like doing these things and you have that. And then there are some who, you know, they want to have a career, but, you know, they want to kind of have that quieter personal life. They don't, you know, necessarily want to be recognized in the grocery store. So you have to first define what success is to you. But then, you know, success is always, it's better to always do a slow and steady build, you know, like I don't know if it's a quote or, but I remember learning when I was doing consulting and with business is that, you know, you fail at the same rate that you succeed. And so people who spike up tend to instantly spike down because that spike is typically not sustainable. It's something that you can't replicate. And so long-term success has to be replicatable. And so what did you do to replicate that success that you can then replicate it again and replicate it again and replicate it again? And then as that builds and grows, and now you have sustainable success that lets you live whatever life
you
like to live.
You want to reach your heights by climbing the mountain, not getting in the catapult.
Yeah. Yeah, because that viral moment, like, you know, people like it, but like, there's nothing you can do to necessarily keep that. And I've watched, you know, not just authors, but people on social media, right, where they kind of go that inflammatory route because, you know, it's an outrage machine, right? And so people interact and interact and interact. But at some point, it's like that machine then turns against them. And now you kind of lose that, not only the interaction, but you know, you didn't really have people there to say like, oh, I wonder what this person's about. They were just there, you know, for that dopamine hit.
So are you saying this is why Hawk to a Girl's crypto crashed and is now everyone's turning against her? She can't sustain that? Like,
I mean, she didn't skew negative per se, right?
I don't actually know. I heard someone was trying to get her to go to jail, but
people want her to go to jail.
So I have no idea.
I'm just waiting for a movie to come out. No, I mean, from what I've seen, yeah. Part two. From what I've seen, like anything that works locally will work globally. You know, so if you find a formula that'll work on a small level, a lot of times you can scale it. Other than like personal stuff, you know, things that you're doing on your own. So, you know, Kevin, for example, in that area, you know, if you're going to local stores and you're making your presence known and you're getting to know everybody, you know, that's something you can't necessarily replicate on a large scale level because you can't travel to that many places, you can't be in that many places. But when it comes to like print ads, online advertising, things like that, I think anything that works small will also work big. And it's worth testing stuff in a small, you know, small area first to see if it works, you know, before you expand. You don't want to throw a gazillion dollars behind it, an ad campaign on a national basis, not knowing whether or not it's going to work, but you could test it in one market. If it works well there, you test it in two more. If it works in all three, then maybe take it national.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's important. Like it's too nebulous to start to be number one in the world, like to try to be the number one thriller author. Like if I'm like, oh, I want to be the number one thriller author in Ontario, maybe that's too big. Maybe it's Southwest Ontario. And you have to really figure out what works on a small scale before you can scale it up. I think that's absolutely true. Were you going to say something, Kevin? Did I cut you off?
No, I'm sorry. I'm being OCD about something on my microphone.
Oh, okay, no worries. So, you know, she also talked about how it's not just book launch. Like, you have to connect between launches with your readers. So I'm curious, what do you all do to connect with your readers between launches? Because I find that kind of perplexing sometimes too.
Well, a lot of authors don't get out there at all, at least on the traditional side. You know, like, they're out there for those, you know, couple weeks to a month where the book is actually out, and then they've got their book tour. A lot of times it's all happening at the same time. And then they vanish again, you know, for a year or 6 months until that next book comes out. So that's kind of worked in the past. I don't think it works in today's world. I think, honestly, doing stuff like this, you know, Writers Inc., we're out there once a week, you know, we're in front of people. I think that kind of thing is helpful because it's not tied to a particular book. In my world, I've got a ton of books coming out, so I'm putting out, you know, enough books where I can keep talking about them. Where I'm running into a problem is, like, trying to figure out, like, I do probably 3 to 4 interviews or so a day at this point, and I need to figure out when those are going to actually air, because, you know, an interview I do today may not come out for 3 months, and, like, the book that I'm pushing 3 months from now may be different from the book I'm pushing today. So yeah. I've got to try and figure all that out too.
I'm constantly trying to talk to my platform, you know. That's one of the reasons I do. So I have a Substack that I do weekly, and that's kind of my newsletter, but it's also my outreach, because Substack helps me bring in subscribers, free subscribers usually, but some paid as well, but from, you know, from their stable of readers. And you know, I make the rounds on social media and that sort of thing, and it's all very personable and engaging is the goal. I want to touch base with these people as often as possible. I want my name to be top of their mind. You know, someone joined Substack and it alerted me, but they joined Substack, and in their little, you have to write a little bio about yourself, and they said, I'm a huge Kevin Tomlinson fan. And so I screen captured that, you know, and I asked if it was okay. I shared that in various places, because I'm like, that's what I want. I want people to, it's not necessarily about stroking my ego, but I think there is a sort of add-on effect that happens when people see, like, someone in their community likes something. They want to try it out too. They want to like it too. So I want to encourage that as much as possible.
That's very cool. Yeah.
And it was not my mom.
It's not your mom. Way.
So I know it's the first thing everyone's
going to
ask.
I'm going to double check on that to make sure that it's not your mom. She also suggested book awards, NetGalley, Goodreads giveaways. I know, JD, you do NetGalley and Goodreads. What about book awards? Do people apply for these?
I do.
You do?
Yeah.
I get them in my email sometimes, and I'm like, is this legit? Who is this? Like, I don't know.
I don't know that it's ever netted me much in terms of new readers or anything, but I think there's a little bit of street cred that goes with being able to say that you're an award-winning author, and so I do it. And that part may be more ego for me. Like, I want to know that my stuff's good enough to win something, but I think it is. I don't think that it's going to move the needle on sales for you per se, but I think it does help with name recognition, you know. And I'll do all kinds of crazy things. That's the only reward for me, is that more people know who I am. That's kind of the point. The more people who know who I am, the more likely it is they're going to try one of my books, and then that might lead to other things.
I think it comes down to that one line of credibility that everybody, like authors, put right above their name. You know, like, when you first start off, you want to have something above your name. So if you can say award-winning author, you know, right above your name, I think it's an easy first step. You know, then best-selling author, you know, if you hit a bestseller list, that can go up there. New York Times bestseller can go up there. Amazon bestseller probably could. It's gaining a little bit more traction than it did in years past. But, you know, like, each of those things, I think, like, once you get one, like, I'm a New York Times bestseller at this point, so I would probably never put, you know, award-winning author anymore on there. You know, like, there's like a tier to it. You know, but I think any of those are beneficial from a marketing standpoint. They do, you know, create some credibility for you.
That's why I put best-smelling author on all my books. And I think that Kevin Smith would agree.
Well, I don't know. You smelled him. I'm not sure if he smelled
I think he
you.
Got a nice whiff of Kevin in front of him too. It's hard to avoid.
Oh my god.
Dude only comes up to like my chin.
And JD, who is up next week?
Next week, we've got Tom Bromley coming on. Tom is an author and ghostwriter of over 15 books, including prize winners and international bestsellers. He also has over two decades of experience in the publishing industry as a commissioned editor at Little Brown and Portico. He's taught novel writing for a number of universities. He's basically a wealth of knowledge on both the writing and publishing front. So he's going to be here to tell us all about it.
Sounds great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.